British Guiana, which is in South America and part of the West Indies, and now it's known as Guyana. I was born there because my father was working there in the YMCA as a YMCA secretary, but also because my mother had lived there and she'd been born there, and her parents and her grandparents. So the family history actually goes back to the 1850s in terms of my relatives living in that colony, having come out from Wales and England in the 19th century. I only lived there for a year or two, a year, and then we went to England while I was quite very small, and then we went to live in Jamaica again within the YMCA until I was seven, and we moved to the UK. And by that time, that was all during the war, I was living in Jamaica. So by the end of the war, there weren't many ships, but that was the main way to get to England in those days. But we got a plane to Trinidad, and might have been a seaplane, and then a train up through Florida to New York, and then a ship from New York to England. And then my father started working in the north of London in the YMCA there, and there was a house next door to the YMCA building, and we lived there for almost 14 years. And my parents moved to Leeds in the north of England. By that time I was a student in the University of Melbourne, London. And I had got to know Frank Ford, and we were at a college called the London School of Economics and Political Science when I was studying a history degree, a Bachelor of Arts, and that came to an end in July 1960. I got married a few weeks after that, and the terms of the marriage were for Frank's question, will you marry me and come to Australia, all in one breath. So it was not negotiable to let, he was under bond to the Education Department of Victoria, and so he wasn't in a position to live in England at that stage. And so I made the bold decision to accept and go to Australia, which was a heavy blow to my parents and my sister and my brother. But I've been here ever since. I have been back quite a few times, including 1967, when we actually went for a whole year, and one of my children was actually born there, my son David. So Frank and I were married in 1960 in London, because I wanted to be married in England. So he came out, by that time he was back in Australia teaching at a very new high school called Sunshine West High School. And he got leave for a month, came over for the wedding, took out a big loan from the bank to pay for the fare. And we were married for 55 years almost, and he died 7 years ago. And we have five children, wonderful children, and four grandchildren.
Do you remember what it was like to leave England? It was the terms of your marriage. What was it like to say goodbye? Do you remember that time?
I remember it quite well. I travelled by plane. It was about a 24-hour flight. And I wasn't allowed to stop anywhere because Frank sponsored me as a £10 tourist. So which meant that he paid 25 Australian dollars or £10 in English currency. And I came out as a £10 POM. And the plane left Heathrow Airport, stopped at places like Beirut, Karachi, Calcutta, possibly Jakarta, and then Darwin and Sydney and Melbourne. My memories of that time, it was hard to say goodbye to my family, and I'm very conscious of the fact that it was a very heavy blow to them. But I was keen to marry Frank, and I was also keen to have a family. I didn't really want to postpone having children too much later. So within a year of my arriving in Sunshine, I had my first child, Frances, who was born in Sunshine Hospital. So.
And just in terms of practical things, what was the luggage that you could take with you, given that you were setting up and to settle here? What sorts of things do you remember taking with you?
There were two sets of luggage. One went by sea and went quite a bit earlier than myself. And then I came by plane with perhaps two or three cases, as whatever the maximum luggage allowance was. Frank had one suitcase. I can't remember exactly how many cases I had, possibly two. And in terms of the sea voyage luggage, I had a very little wooden bookcase with a glass front, which I loved very much. And my dear dad made a special wooden crate to pack it in.
Yeah.
So that came out, and possibly a tin trunk and a few other trunks. Bought a few books, probably. But the bookcase is still with me, and also the crate that my dad made became another bookcase. And I think I probably also packed stuff in tea chests. Because I was just married, I was given a few presents, though I think a lot of people were very thoughtful and gave us money instead of items. But we had to be very careful with not bringing too much on the plane.
And I was wondering whether you remember those first days and weeks and months in Australia, what that was like for you? And to what extent was it as you might have anticipated?
I hadn't had a lot of time to work out what I was actually going to encounter. I think I read a couple of books on Australia, but I was finishing my arts degree and I had my finals in the June, July. So I think I was more working on those things rather than preparing for Australia. When I got here, that there were sort of two environments to get used to. One was the Sunshine environment, and I just briefly, we drove through it from the airport and went up to Ballarat, because Frank's family were a farming family who lived in Ballarat, and they were much more traditional than many of the Sunshine people. I was very, in terms of Sunshine, I was fascinated by the multicultural aspect. I was very appreciative of the very warm welcome I received from Frank's friends, including some lovely women, one of whom gave us a couple of rooms of her house to live in for our home for the first couple of months of living in Sunshine, because Frank was teaching in Sunshine at the time. It's at the new high school of Sunshine West. In terms of my country-based Ford family, that was a very different culture, probably both to the Sunshine culture and to anything I'd experienced. For example, I was asked whether I wasn't going to wear a hat to church by a family member. I was asked if they could see my trousseau. And I said, well, I've just got a couple of things in a suitcase. And they were very welcoming. They put on a big party for the whole district, and all the local people in the district brought presents. And one of the things that shocked me was that the men of the at the party were in the farm kitchen, and the women went to the parlour. So there was a sort of distinct segregation of the sexes in this. And then later on we all gathered and ate very nice refreshments. But this was a huge culture shock to have, to like a time warp, that we'd gone back to 100 years before, where the men and women did not mix to the same extent. There was a bit of that in Sunshine, in the sense that most of the organisations connected with the church, which I got involved with, the local Anglican church, that was fairly gender-based, women's organisations and men's organisations, with the exception perhaps of the Sunday school, which had men and women teachers and girls and boys in the Sunday school. So a lot of my first contacts were people belonging to the Anglican church, which was then known as St Mark's. And as I said, the people were very generous and very kind and very welcoming. And I guess I'll always be grateful for that. I remember seeing some ladies wearing black near the station, and I guess that they were the Italian Maltese women. That was something I wasn't used to. I remember being surprised that there weren't any brown people around, because I had been living in London, where there were a lot of West Indians, a lot of students from India and Pakistan. The YMCA, where my dad worked, had a lot of overseas students. And although Australia, and Sunshine in particular, was very multicultural, it was a European multiculture. Mm. It was before Gough Whitlam and the beginnings of Asian migration. I mean, there was a white Australia policy, and it was... and that was evident in my application to be an assisted person. I put in my application with details of my birth in Guyana, in the West Indies, and I received back an inquiry as to what my lineage was in terms of my West Indian heritage. Mm. And did I have any ancestors born in the UK. Mm-hmm. And I was extremely annoyed. I provided them with the information. My father was born in the north of England, but my mother, as I said, her family had gone back several generations to either Wales or England. So I thought that was a bit off-putting. I had given to understand that Australia was famous for gambling, sport, alcohol, none of which I was interested in, particularly sport. My Ford family relatives were very interested in sport, but they didn't hold it against me that I didn't play tennis. They didn't drink or gamble, which was lucky. I do remember the Derrimut Hotel, not going into it, but noticing that a lot of men would go there on Friday nights. It was called the Friday Night Swill. And because the pubs shut at 6 o'clock on a Friday in those days, and it was a very popular drinking place for the local gentlemen. And that was, to me, unusual.
So it sounds like the church and your husband's friends provided lots of social contacts that you could make and settle into this new environment. Is that the case?
Yes. Frank's high school, because it was very new, it's a very small staff. I mean, it was only Form 1 when it started, that they were the only students, and they're now the basis of what's called the Thistle Club, the students and staff of former students and staff of Sunshine West High. They're very still very loyal to their school.
Mm-hmm.
They were very kind and welcoming. Again, lots of presents, hospitality. People were very kind in terms of inviting me to their place. I remember especially Doug and Joan Climo. Another a woodwork teacher called Jock Smith. He and his wife were very hospitable, and so things like that was very there were some lovely women who were kind in terms of looking after. Once I had children, they were willing to for me to drop one of my children off if I had to go to the dentist or the doctor, and they would look after the youngest child while I went for my appointment. So that was a big help. One of the most amazing friends were a family called, or a couple, Hazel and Alec Boyd, who came along. Hazel, they were Australian born, had no children. Alec was a printer. Hazel was not working, but she was very involved in the local church of St. Mark's, the Anglican Church. And they decided to take on a job as house parents in a boys' home, and for a couple of years, and they invited us to live in their home in Selwyn Street opposite Selwyn Park for a couple of years, for 2 years, which we did. And so that was a wonderful thing to happen. We'd been living in two rooms initially, and then a small flat within a McKay house. I was sort of made aware of the McKay family partly through the stories of my first host, Mrs. Klinick, who had given me a great insight. She said, "Hey, God made the world, but H.V. McKay made sunshine." And her husband had been an engineer at the factory, and she gave me the impression that sunshine was very caught up. Most of the people in the church, office bearers, the men, were involved in the factory, which was then called the Sunshine Harvester Works. It was, Massey Ferguson, it was changed to Massey Ferguson by 1960, but it wasn't often called that. It's called McKay's.
Sounds like your experience was quite positive and supportive. Were there any difficulties? Would you, if you think back, can you say something about the main difficulties of settling into this environment, Sunshine?
There was a difficulty about voting in a local election. I went up to, I've forgotten what election it was, but Albion Primary School was the voting place, and I was told when I turned up to vote with Frank that I was not on the roll, and I was somewhat upset. So Frank protested officially, and somehow he got three votes for the household, so that I had a vote, and he had a vote, and there was a spare vote. It must have been a local government election, but that was a bit of a blow. It was a shock that quite a few things you had to pay for that in the UK had been for free, because it was in the welfare state of Clement Attlee post Winston Churchill, just after the war. That many things were free, like medical treatment and dental treatment and things like that. I found the infant welfare system quite supportive, though a bit overpowering, somewhat bossy, telling you how to bring up your children, but more supportive than overbearing. So it was a good resource. I think mostly my experiences were positive rather than just those isolated instances. I didn't have a, we didn't have a car for a couple of years, so I was walking everywhere. Frank would ride a bicycle to school, and I rode a bike too. I did get knocked over once, but which was a bit of a shock, but that wasn't too bad. And then I eventually didn't get a driving license until my fifth child was born. And then after that, I've been driving quite a lot. Yes. But that made a difference, I think, to mobility. I used to, because Sunshine is so close, it's relatively close to the city, I would, if I needed items for the household, which I did perhaps in my first few years setting up house, I could easily get the train into the city and find shops there that had things that I needed. So I was quite appreciative of that.
In your own book, your second book, Harvester City, you do mention how the British migrants found the transport difficult with only a bus and lots of walking.
I had forgotten that. What the British migrants found very difficult, one of them in particular mentioned it, was the outside toilet. And in the house that we lived in from the friends who lent us their house for 2 years, there was an inside toilet in a sort of added on section to the house. But when we bought a house in King Edward Avenue, the toilet was outside, and my mother was shocked that her daughter would be going out in the rain. And she thought, she also thought that corrugated iron roofs sounded very primitive. That didn't worry me either, but we eventually did get an indoor toilet put in the laundry of our King Edward Avenue house. But that was another thing that was a bit of a surprise, that not many people had washing machines. My mum had a washing machine in England, that most people use coppers, boiling the sheets and in these coppers, which got very hot water. And one of the houses we lived in at the corner of King Edward Avenue was a brick thing with a fireplace underneath. So it was it was a wooden wood fire copper. The house where we lived in opposite Selwyn Park was a gas copper. But that was, in some ways, the technology of was more primitive than I had expected it would be compared with England and UK. And my parents were not an affluent family, because my father worked for the YMCA, which paid a very modest salary, and my mum didn't work, so we had a very modest income. We didn't eat meat every week or anything in post-war Britain. I mean, we didn't eat meat every night. We had lots of things like cauliflower cheese and that sort of... So, in a way, there was plenty of food here. And one of the things I quite enjoyed was Sunshine Market, which was a very live place in those days. Now it's just been taken over by one shop. But in those days, there were many stalls, fruit and veg, fish, meat. And I really... and different nationalities running the stalls, and I found that very exotic and quite delightful. I enjoyed going to that market. The other different thing with the delicatessen shops, I hadn't encountered those much in London, even though I lived in multicultural London. Delis were, I don't think, were very common then. So that was interesting to come across those folk.
Was there ever an element of homesickness? Because in the 10 Pound Poms book, the one by Hamerton and Alistair Thompson, they say that homesickness was a common experience, and in fact a quarter of the migrants eventually went back. Was homesickness as...
I think on the whole it wasn't a big factor. Partly because I was married to an Australian citizen, and partly because the people in Sunshine were so welcoming, and ditto the Ford family in the country Victoria. I do remember one occasion where I was in church, and there's a psalm that says, "How can I sing the Lord's song in a strange land?" And it sort of really made me feel very emotional, because I sort of thought, yeah, that is quite, that's a big thing, you know.
Mm.
So it's only occasionally. I did write home on these blue airmail letter forms every Friday night and take it to the post box. And my mum was very good, and my dad too, sending letters back. So it was much more, I mean, we didn't have email in those days. Phones, it wasn't easy to make an international phone call. That was a big deal. Though that became more common later on. Then in 1970, which is what, 10 years later, we did have a phone which could take an international call. And my mum rang me up to tell me my dad had passed away, just driving the car, had a heart attack.
Mm.
And that was really sad. So he never visited me, but she did. My mum came several times, and I did go back quite a lot of times, at least 10 times. Yeah.
And the £10 POMS was often derisory, and you mentioned that in your book, that there was a little bit of seeing the British as other. Did your Britishness come to the fore in your day-to-day interactions in the society? And were you aware that there was an element of, for whatever reason, dislike of the British migrant?
I don't remember any anti-British sentiment, really. But what there was a strong feeling about was a wariness of the so-called new Australians. I remember an advertisement, because we were looking for accommodation at one stage before we had this generous offer from these friends. And so I was reading advertisements, and there was one, "No new Australians need apply." And I thought, well, that's not very nice or welcoming.
Did you see yourself as a new Australian?
No, no. That was more, I think this is a point that Alistair Thompson makes, that the term new Australian was applied more to the European,
yes,
Australian migrants rather than to the British. Mm. On reflection, there weren't many British people that I came across in Sunshine. There were one or two families connected with the church, and there were one in particular I'm still friends with, the daughter of that family, and in fact she was involved in the Operation Snail migration, and such as family are in the Harvester City book. But I think that my case, as it were, is very atypical. In other words, I didn't go to a migrant hostel, though I actually taught English at a migrant hostel for a while, but by that time there were not many British migrants. They were from all over the place, Europe, Asia. So I think that the Britishness, in a sense, started to recede into the background. And when I went back to England in 1967, I met a friend of my mum's who was a school inspector, actually, and he said, "I'm sorry to see that you have an Australian accent." So I'd become very acclimatised, apparently, even to the point of picking up the Australian accent.
And your children, how much of your own British background, did you want them to be influenced by that, or did you accept that they were Aussies?
Well, because we went back in 1967 when my eldest daughter was 6 years old, she had to go to an English school, English primary school, and then my second daughter went to a kindergarten, which was quite hard on her. My one and only son was born in England, so he could have a British passport if he wanted. I think they enjoyed being in, and I believe my daughter Madeline, who's my third daughter, probably had a slightly different accent to her sisters because she was learning to speak at a time when we were in England, and she had a fair bit to do with her maternal grandparents. So I think that they enjoyed their time in England, but I think it was a bit of a disruption in a way, because then they had to come back and get used to Australia. Mm. And in fact, the English schools were somewhat more advanced in what they expected. Mm. The first grades, beginners and first aid grades, so that my eldest daughter was reading lots of books. Mm. At the age of six, and she was being expected to write, you know, "Mine today is Friday." And one of the things that struck me about the schools was that, this is not to do with English, but it compares with UK, expected to pay for all the school requisites, you expected to buy your pencils and pens and exercise books. Mm. And I got used to the welfare state where the high schools provided all your school textbooks, and all you had to do was to put a brown paper cover on them or replace the cover. Mm. And whereas in Australia, you were buying all your textbooks and you were buying all your school textbook, exercise books, paper, pens. So I was conscious of that difference between the British welfare state and the Australian pay-as-you-go sort of pay for what you use. The children, I think they got used to being, I think they see themselves as Australian.
Mm. In the Tin Pan Poms book, that aspect that you've already mentioned about the segregation of women and men was striking to many British migrants, particularly the urban migrants who came. The other factor that they comment upon was the lack of class distinction. Not that they didn't identify a sense of class within suburbs here and people who saw themselves as better off. But are you able to make any comment about the more evident class society in England as opposed to this more egalitarian society here in Australia was a feature to some, or evident to some, or seemed to be?
I think I was aware of a sense that Australia was a land of opportunity and less emphasis on your background, though there was a strong east and west side of Melbourne that became fairly, people who lived in the eastern suburbs found it quite a trial to come and visit us in Sunshine, even though we're only 20 minutes from the central business district of Melbourne. We've got a couple of slightly derogatory remarks that because we lived in Sunshine from friends that felt that the eastern side of Melbourne was more respectable and to be valued, which of course would make me much more pro-Western suburbs than I would otherwise have been. So I was more conscious of being aware of that. In England, I don't think I was conscious of us because I lived, my main world was a girls' school, a state high school. My sister went to a very well-known girls' school. It was one of the first girls' secondary schools in England, I think it was called the North London Collegiate School. But I think that England was not as class conscious as other people have experienced. I found England less class conscious than many other people have. But perhaps that was because my father was a YMCA secretary, and he was, although he'd been born in Middlesbrough, the son of a metal worker, he was very at ease in any society, and ditto my mother, whose dad was a managing director of the main firm in British Guiana. Both of them got on well with anybody in London, and because we had all sorts of people living in the YMCA, and they were very hospitable and would come over on Sunday nights for coffee and sandwiches. And I think that I wasn't... I found it difficult to come to terms with the whole theory of class. I probably still do. It wasn't a meaningful concept to me.
And Owen, can you share something about your work history, because it's a significant part of your life here, and the impact that you've had?
Well, when I got married, I was keen to have a family, and so I rushed into having children and had four children within, well, five children with by 1971, so that's within 11 years my five children were born. So I think there wasn't a lot of work done in those years. I did do a couple of short stints. One of my first jobs in Australia was invigilating examinations, because that was a casual job that was available. That was in my first few months living in Sunshine. Could get the train into the city and invigilate the exams in the exhibition building. That was quite an interesting experience. So that was one job. I think I did also very briefly work in a laundry in Brunswick for a couple of weeks in the one summer.
Was the work important to supplement the income?
Yeah, I think I felt the need for a little bit of extra money. Frank probably wasn't. Frank was earning a reasonable salary, but I think I just thought it would be good to try a little bit of extra. I then did a little bit of teaching on a night class in the mid-60s, but didn't really do much teaching until 1969, when Marion College advertised for a history teacher, and a friend of mine who was also a teacher encouraged me to apply, and it was a Roman Catholic girls' school, and there were not many people with tertiary qualifications around wanting to teach at that stage. So I just did a couple of afternoons a week teaching history to a class of year 12s whose teacher had become unwell, who was a very elderly nun and who ruled them with a rod of iron, and they had five textbooks between them. So I was able to lend them lots more books than they had had. The school had no library. It was before any state aid for church schools. They were very, very deprived intellectually, but they all did well in their exams, and they mostly became teachers. There was a class of about 11 girls, really lovely young women. And then, of course, I decided that I should, as I was teaching and I didn't have a teaching qualification, I should do my Dip Ed. So I enrolled at the University of Melbourne. And so I was keeping up a little bit of part-time teaching and doing the Dip Ed subjects. And they've very kindly let me, the University of Melbourne, let me do my teaching practice in the school I was teaching at anyway. Mm. So that was, I was trying to show slides or on a film strip, and it was getting in a great mess. And the lecturer who came to observe me sort of made the comment that I should sort of be more wary of using visual aids unless I was really confident with the technology.
Good advice.
Yeah. I can remember some of the girls were very multicultural. I mean, a lot of them are Maltese, because Sunshine West is a Maltese, very Maltese. A few Greek, quite a few of Polish and Dutch and Ukrainian. It was really a good experience to be at that school. And the nuns were, particularly the Mother Superior, Mother Frances, very wise, sensible woman, and later Sister Bridget Arthur, who's become quite a radical in her retirement and doing lots of good things to help asylum seekers. So it was a good experience to do that sort of work. The Dip Ed led me on to eventually do a Master of Education, which took me many, many years. And I wouldn't have managed to finish it if it hadn't been for a very good supervisor whom you know, called Dr. Marjorie Theobald. I had got involved with an environmental group about some of the crises affecting Western suburbs in terms of permits granted to industries that were polluting. And that sort of somehow led me to getting to know Joan Kerner. And that eventually led to her encouraging me to apply for a position in one of her projects, which was a Living Museum of the West. And I became its first director in 1984. So I was the founding director of a new museum which had no objects and no intention of focusing on objects, and saw the region as the museum and the museum as the region. And the committee sent me off to museum conferences to speak about this new museum, and there was such great scepticism in the museum world. But eventually they began involving the community much more in their own programs, and admitted that perhaps we had got quite a good line. And that led to involvement of 14 years as that museum's director. And then when I reached the age of 60, I decided I should retire. And it's about that time that I was starting to work on the book projects, Harvester Town, and then later on Harvester City, which were an honorary project. And I got a lot of help from Prue McGoldrick, who'd written a book on Sunshine and who'd grown up in Sunshine, and from Don Gibb, who was an associate professor of education. But they agreed to be my sort of monitoring group for both books, and both have now passed away, but both were terrific support in terms of keeping an eye on what I was doing. But again, I used the style manual quite a bit to have fierce arguments with people who tried to change the punctuation. Mm. So I think my work history is not very typical, just as my migration history isn't typical. Yeah.
And it's all such rich and insightful, I hope very rewarding for you.
Oh yes, I think it opened many doors and met some wonderful people and good experiences, learning curves.
Indeed, yeah. But also the legacy that you leave, you know, the Living Museum with your books, with your research.
Well, the books wouldn't have happened without the help of many people who agreed to be interviewed. When I was preparing for this discussion with yourself, I thought, gee, I wonder if the folk that I interviewed were as nervous about this discussion as I am. And,
I'm sorry.
Yeah. So it's a wonderful thing that people have. I mean, people actually rang me up and said they'd be happy to talk to me.
Mm.
They were keen to share their story, tell their story.
And I'm very grateful that you agreed as well, because you were not too willing initially. One thing that would be most interesting to people would how you balance that word that is so common now, your work and your family life. It seems like there was an enormous amount that you had to do with your work commitments, and yet you had 5 children in the house. How did that all work out?
I think the children have been very tolerant and very supportive, as Frank has, but Frank had, for many of the years that I was also branching out, he had a fairly demanding job, and he was working at Burwood as a lecturer in education, and that's a long journey to take.
Mm.
Left quite early and came back quite late. So, they became quite good, particularly the eldest daughter looking after the younger ones. I mean, when I was at Marian College, I actually got one of the students to do some babysitting for me when I was going into to attend lectures and classes in for my dip ed, and so I did some of the B.Ed subjects. So this young lass very kindly came and looked after the younger children while I was doing that. That was helpful. I think we encouraged them to, we had a washing up roster. We didn't have a washing machine, a dishwasher. So that was quite a big thing in our family. My son was working at the sink washing dishes, and my sister-in-law, Mary Ford, came in and said, "What's he doing at the sink? Boys don't wash dishes." You know, so thanks a lot. but anyway, they got used to that. Probably we're a bit short of space. We thought of putting on another room, because although we've got a big house, a lot of the rooms are very big, rather than having lots of rooms so that each of the 5 children that were sleeping, they couldn't have their own room for many years. So at one stage one slept in the caravan. One tells me she slept in the laundry, which I don't remember, but she remembers it. And we have a small sunroom. The youngest one slept there for a while. And there was a bit of curtaining off sections of what we call the big bedroom, which was probably once a dining room in the heyday of this house.
Mm.
So I think on the whole, they looked after each other. They probably, to some extent, brought themselves up. And perhaps having a big family, there is much more mutual support than many outsiders would realise.
Mm.
Between the, they do look after each other, and and it's really quite delightful. They get on well with each other, and they're helping me with the project at the moment to deaccession books, and that's quite amazing that they're going to, that they're still working together and getting on with each other.
And just one question. You've spoken about the places where you lived, and now you're in this lovely house. Can you say something about this particular house? When did you move in here?
We moved in here into this house in 1971 because we were living in a much smaller house, two or three blocks away, King Edward Avenue. And we had just had our fifth child, and her bassinet was sitting on top of it. She's top of a chest of drawers. This causes jokes in the family as to whether she was on top of the chest of drawers or in the chest of drawers. But it was getting a bit crowded, and because Frank needed a study, he had lots of books, and that wasn't feasible to have the children sleeping in the study. So we thought of building on to this nice little house in King Edward Avenue, which now had an inside toilet by 1970. But a builder came and looked at it and said, why don't you just buy a new house, another house? There's one down for sale in Forest Street. It's only £15,000
dollars.
Anyway, so we had a look and decided we would like to acquire it. And so that the family moved in. We took up, there were a lot of felt carpets that we didn't like very much. And we took a lot of them up, and a bit later on, some of it was, the wood floors were stained. Not all have been done. It's got a big garden, so that Frank's a good gardener. He had a grandfather who was a good gardener, and he kept that up and taught his children to be good gardeners, which, especially his daughters. The street's a bit busy, and the trains still make a noise, but that doesn't worry me particularly. The biggest blow was that there was another house, a bit similar to this one, next door, perhaps 1 year younger, 1 year older. This house was built in 1911. I found that out from the rate books. And a big blow was when that house was sold to developers, and they knocked it down and built three-story flats, two-story flats. I think we've enjoyed being here. The house was built in 1911, and its first resident was a chap called Henry Smith, who was the commercial artist for the Mackay family. And I do have at least one metal reproduction of one of his commercial art works, which Melchior got for me, which give an idea of his style. And they lived here till early 1940s. I think they had three daughters, and one of whom died quite young, leaving a daughter, Stella. And I think perhaps she lived with her grandparents, because perhaps her father was away. He was not sure, but anyway, the Smith, Henry B. Smith and his wife lived here until the early 40s. I have met one or two people who tells me that they lived here in the at some point. Perhaps that would have been the late 40s and the early 50s, and then and the 60s, and we came here in 71. So we've been here quite a long time.
Mm.
And we didn't build on. One of the things about it is that nearly all the ceilings are pressed metal, except for the kitchen, which is timber.
Mm.
So we painted we did a lot of painting ourselves in the early days, particularly the ceilings, and a bit of wallpaper. There was a lot of wallpaper. And we did employ a firm to work on the top of the house and do a bit, replace the roof and put colour bond on and ensure that the timbers were in good condition, and the electrical wiring was all replaced. And so quite a lot of the stumps have been done. When the heritage overlay for Brimbank was finalised, they didn't include this house, so I said that it ought to be on the heritage overlay, and I nominated it myself and did my own report, and they put it on. So it would be harder for someone to knock it down, like if I'm dead and the house is sold.
Mm.
It would not be easy for someone to, unless the council changed its policy on heritage overlays, to knock the house down. But it's got a big backyard, so I suspect someone would want to put units up in the back garden.
All right, Owen. So what's the final? Anything we haven't talked about that you would like to add?
Well, I think it's been great to live in sunshine. I really have become very attached to the place and attached to this house. I wouldn't be keen to live anywhere else, really. Yes. So I'm very grateful to the people and been very fortunate. Fortunate life, as another local person wonderful. Once wrote, yep. Mr. Facey.
Mm. All right.
Is that all right?
Oh, wow. That's nearly an hour. Thank you so much.
Yes, you've done well.
Well, you were